I just want to take this opportunity of answering a couple of questions and making a few comments. First question is, which has been asked of me by a number of people, will we do this next year? Yes, we will. We've got 12 months to plan it. It has been a wonderful success from our point of view so far. The attendance has been wonderful. The weather has been very kind to the walkers. And it's just provided us with a wonderful insight into the importance of history to people. And there's no doubt about that. And I'd just like to tell you a couple of little historical anecdotes, and then I'll leave because it's not me. You're here to listen to you. Last night we launched our digital library. This is, in plain English, electronic vehicle for getting out photos and a whole range of things. A gentleman attended last night who enjoyed the evening and has very kindly reported back to us this morning that he went straight home, logged onto the internet, got into Pātaki Puarangi, and there was his mother in a photo. She died when he was 10, and I don't think he'd seen the photo before of the Methodist choir. And so he is, I think, going to see us afterwards to get a copy of it. That'll be complimentary. You won't have to pay for that. And it's just lovely how quick these things happen. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that has been an absolute pleasure for us this week is seeing people staying behind and having little stories and all sorts of things come out. The second little anecdote I want to tell you about is dear to our hearts as librarians. We love our library users very much, be they 97 years old and still using the mobile, as is our, we think, our oldest library user. But I guess sometimes there's always that element of how exciting it is when a bit of romance is brought into it. We do have on the staff at least one, in fact there's probably more than one, who met their beaus here and that was it. And Dale, I think, has been married now for 30-odd years. But our speakers today, Mervyn is a person who has enough sense as a journalist and as a good reader to realise the importance of libraries for a variety of uses. 42 years ago, he actually approached one of our staff, proposed to her outside the Roslyn Library, and here we are 42 years later, they're still together. And he still remembers the most important thing is that probably the most important credit card or whatever you have is your library card. Forget all this stuff with cash registers. It's your library card that is the important thing. So I would like to introduce Mervyn Dykes and the library assistant who made that fatal mistake 42 years ago of saying, yes, let's do that. Overdue charges are obviously very much part of this relationship. 42 years is a long time. It's really a short time. So I'd like to take this opportunity of introducing Mervyn and Tina, who will say a bit more about that fellow that accosted her outside Roslyn Library. Thanks.
Oh, how embarrassing. Well, yes, it's true. Actually, I wasn't a full-time member of the Palmerston North Library at the time. I worked one day a week on my day off from the Manawatu Standard in the Children's Library. And I enjoyed that very much. I think I only worked for about 10 months. It was actually a sort of little part-time way of making some extra money because I was intending to go on holiday to New Caledonia with a couple of friends. But after the time that the friends dropped out, the holiday never happened. But I still remember the days at the library because I really, really enjoyed them a lot. And David Trudgeon was the city librarian then. And I remember I used to see him around a lot because, you know, we used to have contact with the library, us newspaper reporters doing stories about odd things. And I remember breezing in with the confidence of youth one day and saying, you got any jobs going? I can't believe I did that now. But he was very kind and somehow or other there was an opening and so I did something very menial in the children's library. But I really loved it. Anyway, it's not really about me today. So I'm just going to introduce Mervyn to you. usually he's to be found exploring medieval life and times more often than not, but today he's coming a bit closer to home, and he'll be speaking about the more recent past in Manawatu. And yes, libraries have been very important to us, and actually we both grew up with this particular library in its various locations, the Palmerston North Library. So it's special to us and always will be. So without further ado, here's Mervyn.
When I stand here and look at you, I see a whole lot of books on shelves. And you might say, what's he talking about? But you are all repositories of information, of life experience, of individual histories. And they are extremely important to you and to your families. And in some cases, even to the rest of us. But I should sort of say with in Tina's case, we were actually outside the Roslyn Library. She was on a tree stump, and we were having an argument. And she said, you got no claims on me. And I said, well, will you marry me? And she said, yes. And I said, well, right. But it's not the world's most romantic proposal. You know, you understand that, but it's been very important to both of us. Now, I'd like to apologize before I get too far into things, because the title of my talk is Who Makes History? And there will be reference to some of the very important people in Palmerston North. But really what I want to explore more closely is what history is and the who makes it part. And in some of that I'll be drawing on my life experience, because I believe the steps and stages that I went through when I came to grips with history and the world around me are similar to those of most other people. Now, if it comes to nuts and bolts history of the Manawatu, Tina is probably far more qualified than I am to speak about it. Those of you who have read her Memory Lanes will know that she does a lot of digging and delving. And, you know, sometimes it's really nice when she comes home from the library, you know. She kind of lives here. Anyway, one of the early people that I would like to mention is Alexander McMinn. Obviously, because he's a newspaper man. He was the rival to my first newspaper. I'm one of the only working journalists, I think, in Palmerston North who can say that he's worked for both of the city's daily newspapers. I began my career with the Manawatu Times, left it to go to Wellington, realized I'd made a mistake, tried to come back. Before I got here, hostile takeover happened, the paper was closed down, and the dreaded rival, the Evening Standard, was left on its own. But the Times was here first. It didn't publish daily. It basically did in response to the Standard, which started out boldly as a daily. Mr. McMinn, of course, was from the northern part of Ireland. And John Dungan from the Manawatu Times was from the south. Now, that was a recipe for strife from the start. And the two sparred constantly. Now, at one point, after several insults had gone backwards and forwards, Mr. McMinn decided that he would sue his rival for £250. He was successful in court, but only got 25. But that didn't stop hostilities. They were constantly at it. And one day, Mr. Dungan decided that he'd go over and sort this McMinn guy out once and for all. He wasn't there, so he trashed his office. But that's the kind of relationship they had. But with Alexander McMinn, there is much to admire. He came over to cover the land wars. He was a big man, 2 meters tall, 120 kilograms, certainly very, very robust sort of a person. So I admire Mr. Dungan, actually, sort of taking him on, but never mind. He decided that he would also run a newspaper in Woodville, the Woodville Examiner. So what he used to do was make the paper up in Palmerston, and twice a week travel virtually overnight to Woodville with all the type and stuff so that he could assemble it there and produce the paper over there. He did that for 4 years. Four? You know, I would have been dead after about the first 2 or 3 weeks. But this is sort of indicative of some of the persistence, some of the resilience, some of the robustness of the people that we read about in our early histories. Remember George Snelson? Most people know him as the first mayor. But how many people think of his wife, Louisa, who was also a very great force in the community, very attached to All Saints as well? She was a powerhouse. How about James, that is Jimmy Nash, and his wife, Elizabeth Lilly, mostly known as Lilly? They really came into their own during the 1918/19 flu epidemic. And they really were the saving of the town. We had a mayor who led from the front. And he was so good that by the time the government got its instructions out as to what should be done to curb this flu thing, everything was already in place and being done. Marvelous. The city organized itself into blocks. People looked after each other. Some terrible tragedies happened, of course, during this time. But at the end of it all, they were still close together. Now, there's something I'd like to show you. I'll pass it around because not everybody will be able to see it if I hold it up. But one of the things that had happened after all this tragedy, at a time when people said, well, we organized for war, now we can organize for peace, and went ahead and looked after this particular battle. At the end of it all, they thought of the children. And the block groups got back again with a fleet of at least 50 Santas who went around the community taking presents to the children. So we'll just pass that picture around. That's just one of them that you will find in the archives, recording this very, very important time in history. Now, we can think of Bishop Monrad, a former Danish Prime Minister coming to New Zealand and coming to Palmerston North, building himself a home here. We can think of the Vikings. Now, I love Vikings. You know, they really got around the world, and a whole group of Danes arrived here, and really sort of with the start of European settlement. I'm thinking particularly of the Andersons. You remember the cottage in Wakaronga, now it got moved across the other side of the river in later years. There are lots of stories which we can tell about them. The laying of the tramway between Palmerston North and that little upstart town called Foxton, who really thought it ruled everything. And there were times when Foxton really was the major town in this area. But there are so many pioneers and history makers in every walk of life. And then there were those who didn't quite make it. All Saints was without a vicar for a very long time, and it vexed the congregation. They were overjoyed to hear that they were getting one, raced down to the station to see him come in on the train. He was rolling drunk, so they rolled him back on the train and sent him back to Wellington. So people knew what they wanted, right? These people really knew what they wanted. Then there were the Tangata Whenua who welcomed and assisted the newcomers. Some of the early Maori leaders were actually real statesmen. It was kind of like a meeting of two different worlds. But each world had its statesmen. Te Piti Te Awi Awi, whose statue stands in Italian marble in the square. Awani Mahana Te Rangiotu, who was instrumental in some of the land sales that opened up this area for European settlement. He is commemorated in the name of the town Rangiotu and is known as a chief, a lay preacher, and a peacemaker. Matani Te Whiwhi from Otaki, who gave the square its other name, Te Marae Ohene. Now, we can meet these people in Pātake Parangi, the new online archive that opened last night. Now, really, that's history being made in a way, isn't it? History being brought to people. So we've already got a clue as to who some of our history makers are. When we look into the archives there, we can see views of the rough and ready Wild West town that these people lived in. We look at their photographs, we read of their accomplishments, and sometimes we almost revere them. They seem larger than life, heroic, noble, exceptional, and altogether quite like us. Yeah, no, that's not a mistake. That's not a mistake. They were just like us, living their lives with vigor, doing the best they could with what they had. They were makers of history. But you say, well, not, he can't really mean it, that I am making history too, can you? Well, yes, I do. Whether we accept it or not, like it or not, each one of us is an historian. If we weren't, we wouldn't have survived childhood. Now, that's part of my theory. I can back it up with scientific research. I've got some stuff from Wikipedia here, which tells me all about history and where it came from. So it says that history is the study of the past, focused on human activity and leading up to the present day. More exactly, history is the field of research producing a continuous narrative and a systematic analysis of past events of importance to the human race, including the study of events over time and their relation to humanity. Those who study history as a profession are called historians. And we learn that history entered the language in 1390 with the meaning relation to incidents, a story. In the late 15th century, it was restricted down to a record of past events. And the term historians, in the sense of researcher of history, appeared around about 1531. So I have justification for saying that. Now, I'd like you to consider a newborn baby. Scientists will tell us that in the first 4 years of that baby's life, it will acquire about 75% of its knowledge. All that follows after that is really mere detail and embellishment. In those early years, the baby learns how to think, how to talk, walk, feed, relate to others, and do things that will enhance its chances of survival. Now, a lot of these skills, if not all of them, are learned by observation. By observing and pondering the things that happen in and around it, the child manages to cope with the present and prosper in the future. The child has learned from his or her own history. I remember one time when our youngest son was just a baby, Tina decided to go back out to work and see whether she still could. So I shifted my job back to a start at 6:30. I worked for the New Zealand Herald then. So I started at 6:30 at night and went to the wee hours so that I could look after the little guy during the day. And I had some of the most wonderful experiences of my life. I remember once sitting on the carpet in the living room, fooling around with a little recorder, and he was fascinated with my musical genius. And he was reaching out for the recorder to play it himself, and I let him take it, and he put it in his mouth and waited and waited. Nothing happened. Then suddenly he burped. And while I was watching him, I saw the lights come on in his eyes. And that was thrilling. I saw the little connection being made between the blowing and the noise that he liked. That was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And it demonstrates some of the learning processes that we all go through. The past holds the key to the present, and the present has the power to unlock our futures. In the days when I was growing up instead of out, my worldview was rather limited. We then lived in Whanganui. I'd heard the name of the city and the name of New Zealand mentioned more or less together and very warmly, so I figured that one was really a synonym for the other and they could be used interchangeably. Yeah. I'd also heard the name England mentioned. And I was smart enough in those days to be able to work out that it was obviously a long, long way away. It was probably right across the other side of town. But anyway, this was my world. When I went to school, I was fascinated by Romans. I was fascinated with Maori studies. And I was fascinated by knights and Robin Hood. Those things are still with me. It's funny that. I go out and play with big boys now, and we hit each other with real swords. And I shoot people with real arrows. It's very interesting. Now, with many of us, this early conscious learning from the past will eventually move away from center stage while we get on with the business of living life. But it doesn't stop. It's still happening there in a subconscious way. It continues to steadily increase and refine the knowledge which we have and the understanding of the world around us. By the time we are as we are now, very, very valuable books on shelves, we have wisdom. Well, hopefully we have wisdom. We are an asset to the workforce. And it's strange that when we get to this state, so many people want to stick you out to pasture. Here you are able to contribute with your vast stores of knowledge, and yet people consider you a past it. I actually experienced this when I was preparing to return to New Zealand from Canada. And I thought I'd be smart, and I got onto a few websites and started looking for jobs before I got here, figuring I could just skid straight into a job. After all, in my working life, I'd never missed out on a job I'd gone for before, so why should it be any different now? The fact that I'd been working as a freelance writer and actor for about 20 years didn't seem to register with me. I figured, well, that's even harder than what they would ask me to do, so if I can do that, obviously I'm still capable. But no, they ignored me. And the only way, even when I started looking for jobs in that area of Canada, where I could actually get to an interview was to lie. I made sure I didn't put my age on my resume, and I downplayed my experience. I got straight into interviews. Now, of course, the moment they saw me, I was done. But at least I'd get to talk to someone and have a little bit of fun watching them squirm while they tried to explain that they didn't want to take me because they wanted somebody younger without actually saying it. I was still looking for work when I got to New Zealand, so I thought I'd try the old Dominion Post, where in its days of Dominionhood, I was once working there as chief reporter. So I figured fond memories and all that sort of thing give me an inside leg. Anyway, I got rejection after rejection. I think after the third one or the fourth one, I wrote to the editor and said, "Now look, if you've got the guts to tell me, why are you rejecting me when I have all the experience you could possibly need? You'll save us both a lot of time because I'm only going to apply again." The result was that I got a job as the Dominion reporter in Palmerston North on 3 months' trial. Very fortunately for me, the trial worked both ways. At the end of the 3 months, I told them, forget it. Marched down to the editor of the Evening Standard, stuck my head in the door and said, "Got a job?" Joe Myers, who was the editor then, said, "Yes." I said, "Good, I'll start in a month." Walked back upstairs to the Dominion office and resigned. So here I am, probably the oldest journalist in the office. It's a lot of fun. People are always yelling out, "Hey, Merv, how do you do this? Hey, Merv, how do you spell that?" Even the voice comes from the editor's office. "Hey, Merv!" You know, and everybody uses me as a repository of knowledge, which is really quite fun in a way. But many years have passed by since that little boy in Whanganui first tried to come to terms with the world. Now, I've since been to places like Australia, America, Canada, various African countries, England, Ireland, other parts of Europe. While they're certainly much further away than across town, they have been made closer in time by the speed of modern travel. Now, there are a few countries on Earth more than a day away. That is, unless you count in the transit time to and from the airport, but that's something else. But what's more important is that in some of these places, it's impossible to move without running into evidence of the history we learned about at school. Now, when Tina and I came out of Les Miserables in London, for instance, during our first visit to England together, we hailed a taxi. The driver asked us where we wanted to go. And I said, "Well, anywhere you like, so long as you end up in Russell Square." What happened next was mind-boggling. He took us around the street saying, "Over here we have this." It was a great landmark that I'd heard about. "And just across the street there is that. There was another one. And 100 yards down the road there is this, that." All the way around the street. And honestly, my mindset had them miles apart. But they were yards. And then I realized that what I was looking at was a world that was quite different from my own. This was one made for people who walked or maybe rode in carriages, not got zipped around by an infernal combustion engine. I've stood in a church in Cornwall that is so old that it had moss growing on the inside walls. It was built in the 10th century. I've seen Stonehenge, Avebury. I've descended 95 feet into a subterranean chamber in a megalithic tomb in Ireland. And I've looked in awe at the hundreds of tons of rock above my head. Now, I should say that on the way down, we passed through a series of doors which got progressively smaller and smaller and smaller. By the time I got to the last one, I was really worried. I thought, well, one of these doors, I'm going to get stuck in it, and that's the end of the tours for the day, you know. But the last one, I managed to sort of thread my right arm, like a hokey-cokey, right arm in, left arm, you know, and I managed to get through, and I sort of squirmed up. I was looking directly at a tour guide looking at me, really eyes bulging, mouth open, and I said, "It's marvelous what you can do with a good pound of kiwi butter." But Now, I've felt tears come to my eyes in the Roman baths in the town of Bath when I thought about all the living that had been done there over the millennia. And then there was the water from the ancient rains which had fallen in the Mendip Hills and taken 10,000 years to filter its way through to the point where it bubbled up on the sacred spring at a nice 45 or 46 degrees C and rich in minerals. While I was at Bath, I talked my way into a civic dinner that was being arranged for travel writers. Hey, I'm a writer and I was traveling, right? Okay, so I got invited to this big dinner and we were all sitting up there in the pump room, noshing away mightily. And I was looking out the window down to the lower level where you could see the old bath and things. And it was too much for me. I got up and pretended I was going to the toilet, scuttled down the stairs, and walked around the museum part itself in the darkness. Well, there was a little bit of light coming from wall sconces, but it essentially was very, very dim down there. And walking around in the darkness was an incredible experience. Every little noise that I heard, every little whisper or clinking of rock or something, I had the feeling it could have been a Roman scuttling around the corner, just one jump ahead of me. And maybe if I walked a wee bit faster, I'd catch up. Wonderful, these touches of history that we experience. Now, I'm talking about some that are, you know, obviously the UK and so on, but we have the same touches of history here when we go into old homesteads and various other places. As a keen longbow archer, I wandered through the remnants of Sherwood Forest, desperately trying to get lost. But alas, it's now too small and too manicured. In Canterbury Cathedral, I walked in the cloisters, marveling at the sights around me and saying, oh, did medieval man really build this? Then I looked down and realized that the flagstones I was walking on were actually tombstones. Many of them, you can still see the dates and the names inscribed on them. So then I go crazy all around the tombstones trying to find the oldest one. Then when I leave the cathedral, I go out into the street, wander down and see the frontage of a shop sticking out over the footpath, established 1554. Oh, by that time I was reeling. You know, anybody looking at me would have thought that I was drunk. When really the strongest things that pass my lips are wine gums, ginger beer, and hot curries. But, you know, it was intoxicating just to be exposed to so much history in doses like that. And it's obviously, by the way I'm talking, you'll see that it's something that's never left me. I've always had a love for history. I've always had a fascination for things that have stories to them. And this was really overload. Now, you'll also probably be aware now that I like to laugh a lot. I like to see people laughing. I think that laughter is essential to good health. But I also think that it enhances learning. While I was on my travels and seeing some of these sites, these things that were important to history, like, say, maybe walking the battlefield where William the Conqueror defeated Harold Godwinson, places like that, you feel that you can actually sort of reach out and you can touch things. You can touch the history. When you're in the Tower of London, you'll see the medieval graffiti that's been scraped into the walls by prisoners. You can run your fingers down it and feel it. But there's also an invisible history swimming around us every day. Some of it tripping off our tongues in the conversations we have with friends and family. Did you know that 50% of the so-called modern language that we use is directly linked to medieval times? We're using medieval words and phrases every day. And it's practically impossible for any one of us to go through a day without quoting from Shakespeare. We talk about things vanishing into thin air, the crash of doom and all this sort of stuff. Pure Shakespeare, straight out of Shakespeare. We talk about giving somebody the bums rush. Straight out of Shakespearean time is when you went visiting people. If you were polite, you stayed until the rush light burned down. If you weren't too popular, they made sure you got a short one. Oh, it's that time already. Well, tomorrow's another day. Where to go to bed? And so they got rid of them. We gave them the bums rush. So let's just have a little look at other things too, like our surnames. There was a time in the world when there were no surnames. And there was a time in medieval England, for instance, when about a third of all men were called John. Because in medieval times, they liked to get their first names from the New Testament, Whereas when Oliver Cromwell took over, they sort of turned a bit more towards the Old Testament. So when you had all these fellows called John running around, you had to sort of be able to pick one from the other. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But I've got a phrase sheet in here that I use sometimes when I'm doing night school classes. Now, these are a lot of fun. I'll just pick out a couple of them. We talk, for instance, about a guy being a good trencherman. And most people know still that that means a guy who's pretty good at putting away the food. And they'll know, too, that from medieval times, his food would be coming to him not on a plate but a trencher, either a flat piece of wood or else a slice, a round of the bottom part of a loaf of bread, which would soak up all the juices and so on of the meats. Now, in those days, of course, the bread was usually flat and was cooked in an oven where they put a big fire, heated it up, then put the bread in. So it sort of more or less cooked from the bottom. So the bottom was more done than the top. So if you were a noble, you got the top half of the bread. You got the upper crust, because that's what you were. We talk about a man being chivalrous, having chivalry. Back in medieval times, it was chivalry, and it meant he was good with a horse. Terrible with the ladies, but good with the horse. Sacking and firing happens to you at your job sometimes. That was when you wouldn't take the hint of getting out of town. People helped you. They burned your house down and threw everything out. If you want to go back to Roman times, you'll find a man worthy of his salt. Now, often with things like salt and pepper being very precious and quite rare, sometimes they got part of their money in salt. If he was not worth his salt, he was usually tossed out. Now, from salt, which is sal in Latin, we get our salaries and things today. But other times we talk about people being caught red-handed stealing. In Scotland, it might mean that you'd shot a deer and you were actually in the process of disemboweling it. But in other parts of the world, it meant that you'd been branded a thief and your hands had been dyed with a berry dye, which would last for several weeks. So you couldn't go around all day like this. People would see you for what you were and you'd be caught red-handed. Getting off your high horse. Only the nobles had high horses. So if you were on your high horse, you were putting on airs that you weren't entitled to. And there was a famous Saxon scribe. Now, all of you know him very, very well. His job was translating writings from the continent into his own tongue so his own people could read it. He was a copyist. His name was Xerox. And if you go to an inn or something like that, you might meet a bouncer. Bouncers in the Middle Ages? Yep, but they used to bounce the coins to see if they were false or not. Only if they were false, that's when you really got bounced in the modern sense. Giving somebody the cold shoulder. When they arrived, your hospitality rules said you should feed them. So you gave them the roughest and toughest piece of meat. There's lots of them we can talk about, you know, that are everyday expressions which we use. But when it comes to our names, each one of us is dragging around all sorts of references from the past. Our names can tell us an enormous amount about our ancestors and what they did. For instance, is Anthony still here? The name Lewis is an English Norman first name, but it comes from the Frankish dynasty where Ludovicus the German was in charge and then switches through the German through Ludwig and so on. But it also has an Irish meaning brightness, a Saxon meaning castle, or safeguard of the people. I think that one's very appropriate for a librarian. Our mayor, John O'Naylor, he had ancestors who made nails. Leslie Courtney, she's still here? All right, well, her ancestors came from a town in France on a small hill on the banks of the River Clary, about 56 miles south of Paris. Tina, whose surname is White, was marked in the medieval times, or her ancestors were, because they had white or pale hair. So there's lots of other names we can get along like that one. If we have a look at them a bit more closely, we'll find that people were named sometimes after their occupations, sometimes after physical peculiarities such as white hair, sometimes after where they lived, and sometimes after their fathers. For instance, William is obviously, you know, the name of the man who is now called Williamson, or William's son. We can think of all the Smiths, the Carpenters, the Wrights, all those sort of people who are picking up occupational names. We can think of Whites, were they here? We've said those, haven't we? How about the Atwaters, Atwells, Bridges, Cliffs, and various other names? My own family name, for instance, relates directly to Hadrian's Wall in Scotland. A dyke is a stone wall. And my ancestor, Robert Del Dykes, who was getting around in the 11th century, lived literally in the shadow of that wall. So there are a lot of things that we can go through into that. Now, I've just lost my place here, so I'll just get it back to where we were. I remember at work, they were trying to catch me out on names, and someone said, "What about Lilycrap?" They all sort of stood around smirking, saying, "Let's see him get out of this one." And basically, we need to remember sometimes that if our name is named after a place, for instance, that place might no longer exist. That whole village might have vanished. Or if it's named after an occupation, that whole occupation might have vanished. Or if it's a name like Lilycrap, perhaps we have to say it the way the people who used it first would say it. And in Devon, the words crap and crop sound very close, to this, you know, very, very, very similar. And Lily, of course, Lily is a white. So we're back to the white hair again. So that person would have been a person who had a good thick thatch of white or very fair hair. So all sorts of little secrets can come out about us through our names. So when we think about things, we can look at names like Brewster. Then we find out even a little bit more. We know that, okay, the person obviously was brewing ale, but we also know that it was a woman, because the stir part was usually added to occupations done by women. And they predominated in the brewing trade. Spinster is another one, of course. Sometimes spellings change because they were not very sort of strict on their spellings. If we hear the name Baxter, for instance, would we link it with baker? But it's the same. A Baxter is a baker. It's just the way it goes. And we remember, of course, as I said before, how things are actually pronounced. But when we get around to the point where we say, who is it who is making history today? We look at our town, we look at the people, we see the obvious people like the mayor, civic leaders, entertainers, and others who are making news. Some of those people will vanish altogether from records within the next 100 years or so and maybe never be heard of again, except if a researcher goes after them and finds them. Others will leap forward and become household names, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. We haven't forgotten Guy Fawkes, have we, for instance? You might have read this week that Pamela Anderson made her claim for fame by dancing naked for Hugh Hefner. I think that one will be forgotten very quickly. But one area where each one of us is making history is in our own families. Now you might say, well, how can my family be important? Ask that question to your great-great-great-grandson or daughter and see what sort of answer you get. What you write down now about your personal history will be gold, pure gold. It's something that they can't get anywhere else. So we are all literally making history every day of our lives. When you think about it, every day we step out onto the world and we go somewhere where we've never been before. Now, if that isn't exploring, what is? We can be dead in the head, perhaps, and just go through the motions. Or we can stay alert and really think about what we're doing. And then we can sense the history around us. We can feel the continuity with those who have gone on before. We can reason why they were trying so hard to do certain things and to be certain things. And we can find in our own families traits and peculiarities that might have traveled down the centuries. Now, I was reading a description about one of my ancestors who fought at the Battle of Poitiers, and somebody described some of his physical peculiarities. I have them. Hundreds of years later, I have them. And when I read about it and him, I cannot help but identify with him because of that. Tina was telling me this morning that one of the crazes sweeping the world right now is to Google your own name and find other people with the same name and form little clubs of Joe Smiths or something. You know, people really do identify with them. So your sense in making history could be something simple as being good to your kids. It could be something as simple as going home and writing in your journal. I'm a journalist. A journalist is somebody who keeps a journal. Somebody who makes a daily record of history. Each one of us makes a daily record or can make a daily record of our own history. And some of them that have been made by people who've lived in Palmerston North in the pioneer years that we treasure so much now rest downstairs in the archives of this very library. There are people who have stacks of photographs, for instance, in their families, memoirs and things like that. And you might say, well, what importance is this to somebody else? And you take them into somebody, you know, like Leslie Courtney or something, and you'll be surprised to see them going, oh, thank you, because it is gold. It really is gold. Now, this really takes me probably to the end of my talk. I don't know how I've gone for time or anything like that. It's very easy for me to start talking, very hard for me to stop. At work, they give me a hard time. They say, hey, Merv, you start writing and you don't know when to stop. So it's exactly the same as the talking. But what I would like to say briefly now in finishing is that if anybody likes science fiction and has watched the television series Star Trek, you'll remember the opening words. And we hear the voiceover saying, to boldly go where no one has gone before. That's what we're going to do when we leave this room. I'd like everybody now just to put out a hand and take the hand of the person sitting next to them or put a hand on their shoulder. Don't be shy. Do it. Okay? I can say now, without any fear of contradiction, that you are touching or have just touched somebody who is going to make history. Okay? Somebody who is a historian, somebody who is a valued record of the past. So go and be happy in your history. Thank you. Being encouraged to talk again. This is this is great. I cannot remember without looking them up, but they are, the Times probably started from memory probably about 5 years earlier, but it didn't come out daily. 1875, do you think? Yeah, the Standard was about 1877 or 78? 1880? Yeah. There's about 5 years difference between them anyway. The first Standard that came out was just a single sheet folded in half. I'm really, really biased on this one. I think that Palmerston North lost its best newspaper. My boss said he was going to come today. but I think that that was really a tragedy for the town. Anyway, enough said about that.
Any other questions? Yes.
I'd like to make one observation. Thank you. It's great fun. But I had a lot of your experiences in England and Ireland, and that I came back with was how lucky we are, because actually they've lost so much as well. Where we're at the
I would agree with that completely. Now, some of you might know that there's an exhibition on over in Tamanawa. A gentleman called Pat White from Gladstone has put it together. He'll tell you how he started on that exhibition. He went to hear a friend give a poetry reading in the library at Masterton. See libraries again? And while he was there, the friend introduced him to a guy called Chris Pugsley, a military historian. And Mr. Pugsley said, oh, Pat White, are you any relation to Jack White up in Taranaki? Well, yes, I'm his son. He told me he had a boy down here, and you look just like him. And he said, I was recording your father just 2 weeks ago. Recording my dad? Why? Oh, I wanted to hear about Jack Dunn. Jack who? And that started the exhibition. Because Jack Dunn, who inspired the Gallipoli exhibition over in Tamanawa now, was Pat's great uncle. He was the first New Zealander to be sentenced to death at Gallipoli. They ran him ragged, as so many other soldiers did. He was in hospital with various illnesses, including dysentery. He wanted to discharge himself quickly so he can get out and join his mates. He put himself out of hospital too soon, went on sentry duty, and was found asleep on sentry duty at night. He was sentenced to death on August the 5th, I think it was, 1915. But his senior officer overruled it on the grounds of his previous good behavior and so on. So he survived three more days to rush up Chanak Bear and have his throat blown out by a Turkish bullet. The richness, it's such a horrible thing to write about, but the richness of that story, I think, is something which everybody could be identifying with. But the point I'm laboriously trying to make is that Pat knew nothing about this man at all. And when he found out about this man who'd been lost in only two generations, it sparked off this entire exhibition, which after it leaves Palmerston North is going to go to the Army Museum in Wairu. So, the point? I told you I talked too long.
No. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you very much, everybody.